Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called The Genius Act in Practice, Key Questions for Stablecoin Regulation. We're very pleased to welcome an excellent group of panelists. The Honorable Michael Barr has been a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors since July 19, 2022, with a term ending January 31, 2032. He served as vice chair for the supervision of the Board of Governors from 2022 to 2025. Prior to his appointment to the board, he was the Joan and Sanford Will Dean of the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, Frank Murphy Collegiate Professor of Public Policy, and the Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School. He is also a founder and faculty director of the Center on Finance, Law, and Policy. From 2009 to 2010, he was the U.S. Treasury's Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions. The Honorable Summer Mersinger is the CEO of Blockchain Association, where she leads advocacy efforts to advance digital asset innovation and policy in Washington. She previously served as Commissioner of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, nominated by President Biden and unanimously confirmed by the Senate. With over 20 years of experience in public policy and government affairs, she has held senior roles at the CFTC, on Capitol Hill as Chief of Staff to Senator John Thune, and is in the private sector. Alex Pollack is a senior fellow with the Mises Institute. He previously served as Principal Deputy Director of the Office of Financial Research in the U.S. Treasury Department from 2019 to 2021. He was a Distinguished Senior Fellow with the Art Street Institute from 2015 to 2019 and 2021. He is also a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute from 2004 to 2015. He was president and CEO of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago from 1991 to 2004. There he invented the Mortgage Partnership Finance Program, which successfully created front-end mortgage credit risk sharing bargaining in 1997. His decades of banking experience include being a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Greg Zizalis is a partner and general counsel of Multicoin Capital. He manages all legal and policy functions for the firm and works with their portfolio companies on legal and policy strategy. Prior to joining Multicoin, he was a partner in the investment management and fintech practices at Chapman & Cutler LLP, with 12 years of experience counseling clients on digital asset matters. He is a director of the Blockchain Association, the DeFi Education Foundation, Kindly MD, and the Fordham Law Alumni Association. Our moderator, Gary Kalbog, is a partner at Cahill, Gordon, and Randall LLP. He is also a special professor of law at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University, where he teaches derivatives law and banking law. He is a past chair of the New York City Bar Association's Committee on Regulation of Futures and Derivatives, and has over 15 years of experience as a professor teaching derivatives and banking law. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Kalbog, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Hello, everybody. So glad we have everybody together. Now, don't fear that we don't see Governor Barr yet. There's a little technical glitch. We'll figure that out, but he'll sure be on. But I did want to make an invitation to each of our speakers to give a few high-level thoughts on stablecoins generally. For example, you know, maybe Greg, I'll ask you to start. Maybe if you could give us a high level on stablecoins and their role in the financial ecosystem, how they differ from other crypto assets, how we got to this statute that passed last year called the Genius Act. So let me hand it over to you, Greg. Maybe you can provide some orientation for us all.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you to everyone in the society. Really, really happy to be here and happy to try and set the table. I will not promise to do so in under 5 minutes. The origin story for stablecoins begins not in America, but in Hong Kong. In 2014, a group of developers associated with the Bitfinex crypto exchange set out to tackle an issue for Asian crypto markets. Exchanges needed to move dollar value amongst themselves quickly, settle trades in real time, and hold dollar positions. But access to banking was unreliable, expensive, and typically simply unavailable. The answer was USDT, or Tether, the first stablecoin, which was created and live on Bitfinex later that year. Its purpose was not retail payments, but exchange deposit withdrawal and settlement infrastructure. That original use case turned out to be a profound insight. It describes not just the problems facing crypto exchanges in 2015, but also remittance senders in Nigeria, treasury managers at multinationals, and eventually the financial plumbing of the world itself. And it evolved into a geopolitical imperative for America. The regulatory story that followed Tether's inception moved from improvisation to architecture. Tether's early years were not a regulatory success story, anything but. Reserve opacity, a controversial relationship with Bitfinex, and a 2021 CFTC enforcement action were failures both of accountability and regulatory uncertainty. The contrast with what came next, though, is instructive. In 2018, New York's Department of Financial Services approved the first regulated stablecoins from Paxos and Gemini under the Limited Purpose Trust Company framework and Circles USDC under the BitLicense framework. Over the following years, DFS built the template, one-to-one reserves and high-quality liquid assets, clear redemption rights, and independent attestations. That set the foundation for the Genius Act. Now, what stablecoins are, technically and conceptually, matters enormously for the conversation we're going to have here today. Stablecoins are not cryptocurrencies in the sense that Bitcoin or Ethereum or Solana are. They do not ask users to accept price volatility. They do not rely on decentralization for their integrity. In fact, they invert that design choice deliberately. A stablecoin issuer holds assets, issues liabilities, manages minting and redemptions, and answers to regulators and the law. That is a recognizable financial institution. What is new is the settlement layer on which the instrument circulates. That ledger is programmable, globally accessible, always-on asset infrastructure that is decentralized. Distinguishing from L1 cryptocurrencies, stablecoins substitute for algorithmic trust an administered trust, a regulated issuer with verified reserves. The result is an instrument that combines the velocity, programmability, and borderlessness of crypto with the par value stability and, with Genius, institutional credibility of a regulated dollar instrument. That is a genuinely new thing. Functionally, parties with contractual rights with a stablecoin issuer may create or mint a stablecoin by delivery of a dollar for one stablecoin or redeem vice versa. The issuer manages the minting and redemption and holds reserves in the most highly liquid assets, typically short-term treasuries, repos, and some bank deposits. In the open market and commerce, stablecoins technically have floating prices, but those are generally arbitraged as close to $1 as possible. Issuers have a responsibility for monitoring their issuance and the parties with whom they transact and are capable of responding to requests to freeze or seize stablecoins in the market. These mechanisms are familiar to traditional finance, but now can function on these new permissionless blockchain rails. Now, the payment implications of stablecoins are profound, and we're already seeing them realized across the stack. Consider where the friction in payments actually lives. In 2015, the Federal Reserve convened its Faster Payments Task Force and launched FedNow 8 years later in July of 23. The problems the task force was trying to solve were obvious. Americans couldn't move money instantly on weekends. small businesses waited days for settlement, and that ACH batch processing had become a structural constraint on economic velocity. The institutional solution required nearly a decade. Stablecoins are solving parallel problems faster and doing so across the entire MIT payment stack, not just the consumer-facing front end, but also the institutional plumbing. In December, for example, Visa launched USDC settlement in the U.S., allowing its issuer and acquirer partners to settle obligations with USDC on Solana. That is back-office treasury infrastructure at the core of the global card payment infrastructure, and it's already live. The front end of the consumer experience for card networks doesn't change. It's the back-end settlement layer, the place where the banks, acquirers, and networks hold pre-funded Nostro Vostro accounts to cover the timing gaps in legacy settlement. Those are being fundamentally re-engineered. The same dynamic is playing out and will play out in collateral management. Stablecoins enable atomic programmable collateral posting, eliminating the overnight gaps, margin call delays, and operational friction that characterizes today's collateral transfer infrastructure. That matters for derivatives markets, sec lending, and repo markets, the deep institutional plumbing that most people never see, but that determines the cost of capital across the financial system. Which brings us to Genius and to where we are now. The Genius Act did three things that had eluded the market for a decade. It established who can issue, at what reserve standards, and under which regulators. And it solved with clarity the securities laws issues faced by regulated payment stablecoin issuers. The legal gray zone that had suppressed institutional capital, chilled bank participation, and driven innovation offshore is gone. The OCC NPRM issued in February 25th is now turning that statute into the operational architecture for what comes next. So while checking my watch and going a little bit over, I look forward to that the conversation today and the questions Gary has prepared for us.
Well, Greg, I just want to emphasize a distinction that you raised, and that's a distinction between payment rails and other types of crypto or digital assets, which are not for the purpose of payment rails. And I just want to emphasize for everybody listening how important that distinction is, because I think a lot of the people listening think digital assets are crypto. They think Bitcoin or ETH or something like that. And those are functionally different than stablecoin, the same underlying cryptographic technology, right? But functionally quite different. And I note that you made that distinction. You also mentioned FedNow, and I'll be interested to, you know, a question that we were asked or, you know, why do you need stablecoin if you have FedNow? And you know, is there going to be any plan, for example, for the Fed to mandate, because the Fed has the rulemaking authority to have interoperability, to mandate that stablecoins become compatible with FedNow? But let me turn it over. I'm so glad to see Governor Barr. You got a very gracious introduction. So you were fully introduced. So I'm just going to ask you, Governor Barr, to give us some of the high-level policy view on stablecoin.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with all of you in this virtual panel. And I'm sorry for joining you late. I'm glad our technical difficulties were able to be overcome. Let me just speak at a very high level, following up on what Greg said. So as Greg said, last year, Congress passed the Genius Act, which provides some needed clarity to issuers of stablecoins about how they can fit into the regulatory framework. While there's a lot of work to do by the relevant agencies to fill in the specifics during the rulemaking process, increased regulatory certainty could lead to more rapid development of stablecoins. Today, stablecoins are mostly used to facilitate crypto trading and secondarily as a dollar-denominated store of value in some foreign jurisdictions. Stablecoins might also be used to reduce the cost of remittances between some countries, to improve the speed of managing the paperwork and processes inherent in global trade and trade finance, or to help global firms manage their treasury functions. And of course, other innovations in payments may also develop by using stablecoins, tokenized deposits, the systems Gary described, real-time gross settlement systems, or other measures. A key area of concern for stablecoins, however, is the potential for stablecoin use in money laundering or terrorist financing. Since bad actors can purchase stablecoins in secondary markets that may not have customer identification requirements. And in my view, both regulatory and technological solutions will be needed to limit these risks. A second key area of concern is financial stability. While people purchasing something called a stablecoin might reasonably assume that they can rely on redemption at par on demand, the quality and liquidity of the reserve assets backing the stablecoins could make them vulnerable. Stablecoins will only be stable if they can be reliably and promptly redeemed at par in a wide range of conditions, including during stress in the market that can put pressure on the value of otherwise liquid government debt, and during periods of strain on the individual issuer or its related entities. Backing up a step, caution is warranted because we have a long and sometimes painful history of private money created with insufficient safeguards. For example, in the early 1800s, during the so-called free banking era, the United States had competing forms of private money in the form of banknotes, which often traded below par. There were frequent bank runs and even financial panics. And while improvements were made in the 1860s with the National Bank Acts, financial crises persisted. The particularly severe panic of 1907, which featured a run on trust companies that offered deposit products backed by less liquid assets, led eventually to the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913. These same run dynamics occurred in modern times with respect to money market funds, which came under pressure during the global financial crisis and again with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as everyone on this call knows, stablecoins themselves have been subject to valuation pressures in recent years. So the quality and liquidity of stablecoin reserves are critical to their long-run viability. At the same time, stablecoin issuers have an incentive to maximize the return on their reserve assets by extending the risk spectrum out as far as possible. And that incentive can increase profits in good time, but risks undermining confidence during market stress. And as Greg said, to address these kinds of vulnerabilities, Congress passed the Bipartisan Genius Act. And the Act's primary tool to mitigate the risk of runs is limiting permissible reserve assets to an itemized list of high-quality, highly liquid assets. Tight control over reserve assets, coupled with supervision, capital and liquidity requirements, and other measures, could enhance the stability of stablecoins and make them more viable payment instruments. But success in accomplishing these goals will depend on the details of regulatory implementation. Key issues include regulation of reserve assets, the potential for regulatory arbitrage, the scope of permissible activities for stablecoin issuers beyond stablecoin issuance, appropriate capital and liquidity requirements, anti-money laundering controls, and consumer protection requirements. While the Genius Act made important progress in creating a regulatory framework for stablecoins, a great deal will depend on how federal and state regulators actually implement the statute. And that's why I'm happy to be here with all of you, and I very much look forward to the conversation.
So, Governor Barr, I take it that you are suggesting great care in avoiding the historical mistakes that were made, for example, during the era of free banking, where you had these wildcat banks that would issue these notes and then would, you know, people would rely on the notes. There was total non-fungibility among the notes, and it created a lot of commercial disruption. And you see that type of mistake occurring all the way potentially through money markets, where even with money markets, their use as kind of quasi money, leads to potential disruption. And your concern is to avoid that.
That's right, Gary. And you can kind of think of stablecoins as a money market fund stapled to the payment system in the form of a stablecoin. So the issues are very similar issues, but the velocity has changed a great deal.
Great. Well, thank you so much for those introductory remarks. And I now turn it over to Summer Mersinger. Summer, can you give us a sense in your introductory remarks about where are we now? I know there's some significant debates going on in the stablecoin universe. So if you could maybe bring us up to date and give us your thoughts.
Yeah, happy to do that. And thank you all for being here. Always an honor to speak to Federalist Society and these events. So where are we now? We've moved from theory to execution. You know, stable coins are here. They are real payment infrastructure. And part of that is in thanks to Congress passing the Genius Act and the president signing it into law. It brought a lot of validity to these markets, but also gave the markets the kind of additional push to get over that next step to move forward and to hopefully become the payment rails in the future. So I think when you're looking at kind of where are we and what are we dealing with, you know, I look at it as we're in phase two of Genius. Phase one was obviously getting that off of the Senate floor, getting it to the president's desk and getting it signed. And now we're at the point where we've got to implement what the bill that Congress wrote. And there are a lot of regulators involved. A lot of different rulemakings are going to be going on at the same time. And it's going to be very technical, as we've already seen in some of these proposals. So right now, what we're working on and what we're seeing is these proposals coming out. We've got OCC, FDIC, NCUA. Treasury had a notice of advanced proposed rulemaking that they will have a rulemaking coming out soon, a proposal out soon. And so it's looking at all those proposals cross the board and figuring out what that means for stablecoin issuers and those who are part of the chain here to get these, you know, more adoption of stablecoins as a payment system. I think one issue that you will probably hear over and over again in this conversation today is the question around yield. It's already come up in, I believe, Greg's remarks about what is permissible. Genius Act said issuers cannot pay yield, but that left open a door of what about third parties? What about someone who is not the stablecoin issuer? What are they allowed to do? Are they allowed to pay rewards or have a program that incentivizes adoption? So that's a debate that's ongoing. There's a few others point mostly to the OCC rulemaking that we're going to get into, so I don't want to get ahead of our discussion. But for me and the members I represent, we really are focused on the yield issue, getting that right. We're dealing with it through legislation. Normally, you would think a problem like this would be dealt with through the regulation, since we are in the implementation period, but we found ourselves in a situation where Congress is going to kind of reopen the act and legislate on who can provide, you know, we're talking rewards, incentive programs, you know, how can that exist and not look like a deposit account or like you're going to, you know, use stable coins as an alternative to a bank deposit. So that debate's going on now on Capitol Hill. We have seen language go back and forth. There's been a recent proposal that a few of us got a chance to look at from Senators Tillis and also Brooks. I think there's some opportunity to maybe make some changes around the edges. So because right now it's not at a place where I think industry is ready to support. So we're hopeful that we can get it there. And I think that's kind of a big step forward. And then we're just focused on the rulemaking. I mean, this is like the critical point. And as we talk about the rulemaking, one thing I want to remind everyone is proposals are just that, they're proposals. So if you read a proposal and you think that it is, you know, kind of siding with one side or maybe not balanced, they're coming at it from, they really want this information. They really need expertise. They need robust comments. And so I think that's an important kind of point that I hope comes out of this conversation is, you know, look at the proposal, see where you can contribute, where you can offer your expertise, because I think the regulators really would like to learn more and do this the right way so that we have a robust stablecoin payment system in the United States. So with that, I'll turn it back to Gary.
Yes, thank you so much, Summer. And one thing I'll just observe, just for everybody who's listening, what we're talking about stablecoin rewards is, for example, I have a Coinbase account, a legacy account, and I have USDC, which is a stablecoin issued by Circle, and it sits in the account. And I get effectively interest for that balance sitting there. Now, technically, it's not paid directly by Circle. And so there, you know, the view is that it's not interest in the sense that I get interest when I leave something in a bank, in a deposit account. But that's what's being referred to with rewards. And those rewards could take different forms. And part of the discussion is, well, maybe we should only allow rewards for doing something with a stable coin, or maybe we'll prohibit rewards if it's just sitting there statically. But in any event, I just wanted everybody to understand that's kind of the discussion. And when Summer compared it to deposits, you can see how there are some similarities, because now it wasn't always the case, but now demand deposits are allowed to pay interest in the United States. So let me think, and we'll definitely get back to these topics, by the way, Summer. I do have some follow-up questions for you for sure. But let me turn it over to Alex Pollack, just maybe for some overall thoughts and everything we've heard so far.
Thanks, Gary. On the overall perspective, let me suggest that stable coins, of course, aren't really stable, because even if they work perfectly, they're stable relative to the dollar. And the dollar itself is not stable, since it continually depreciates, and automatically, as let's say the central bank depreciates the dollar, it depreciates stable coins, just as a kind of macro issue. So the right way to think about stable coins is part of the world fiat dollar system. And indeed, as thinking of that, one of the most important competitive aspects, at least in other countries, is stable coins as a competitor to the Federal Reserve, since dollar stable coins are a nice substitute for $100 bills for making transactions around the world. That just by way of a few macro comments. His comments, Governor Barr mentioned the financial stability issues. I fully agree. There is the risk that the stable coin will not be stable relative even to the dollar. And that was not, in my opinion, settled by the Genius Act. Consider, for example, as Governor Barr said, that in the 19th century, a lot of states required banks to hold their own state bonds as backing for their currency. But the states themselves defaulted often enough on those state bonds, and the banks also got in trouble or failed. Likewise, it seems to me that a big issue in the Genius Act is the entangling of stable coins and banking risks, putting them together. And it does this, of course, through allowing the reserves for stable coins to be uninsured deposits in domestic and foreign banks. And unsecured deposits in domestic and foreign banks are an entirely different class of risk than are the short-term treasury bills, which dominated at least the press discussion of stable coins. And such deposits introduce much more individual firm and systemic risk than do treasury bills. We're very familiar with banking risk. More than 3,000 insured depositories have failed, for example, over the last half century, and many more would have failed if it weren't for federal support and bailouts of various kinds, including those of 2023, which notably bailed out Circle's stablecoin, along with bailing out the other uninsured depositors of Silicon Valley Bank, which, as we all know, was broke Circle's USD coin lost its peg. When it announced that it had 8%, and I wanted to keep that 8% in mind for a minute, 8% of its reserves tied up in the collapsed lender Silicon Valley Bank. And when the federal government bailed out all the uninsured depositors, it also bailed out the stablecoin, and Circle was indeed the largest beneficiary of the bailout. And the Silicon Valley Bank problem could clearly happen again under the Genius Act, as written and enacted. As Nellie Leung of Brookings, and formerly of the Treasury, has written, allowing stable coins to hold uninsured bank deposits creates direct two-way interconnections between the risks of banks and the risks of stable coins. And it's up to the regulators now to somehow deal with this risk. Let me quickly suggest there are three the components to this we ought to think about. One is interest rate risk. The Genius Act tries to keep interest rate risk out of stable coins. But if you are holding unsecured bank deposits, the interest rate risk of the bank the deposit is in becomes a risk of the stablecoin. So there is interest rate risk to be thought about. The second is affiliation risk. A bank which owns a stablecoin issuer will clearly want to take the proceeds of the stablecoin and deposit it in its own bank. Or conversely, a stablecoin issuer would logically try to set up its own bank, which it could be its parent company, and hold deposits in that bank. In either case, the assets behind the stablecoin no longer are only treasury bills. They're whatever assets are in the bank: commercial real estate loans, sovereign debt, financing private capital, and leverage buyouts, or what have you. And a third separate issue, is the question of dealing with foreign banks and the very different kinds of risk posed by financial systems of obviously very different stability around the world. Now, the regulatory effort is underway. We just mentioned one minute ago, the controller of the currencies, a 100-page or so proposed rule, very dense, I thought, well argued in many ways. But it is ironic that our stable coins are now into 100-page regulatory rules. Let me just quickly mention two of them. The rule recommends that a safe harbor would be if a stablecoin issuer maintains no more, I'm quoting here, no more than 40% of its reserve assets with any one financial institution. In the act, there's no limit about how much of the reserves could be held in the form of deposits. Well, 40%, compare that to 8%. 8% of Circle's reserves got it in deep trouble. What about 40%? Well, if you took it, say, a 25% haircut on 40% of your reserves, you'd be worth 90 cents on the dollar, and that would be a very serious issue indeed. And the OCC goes on to say that it doesn't, quote again, I'm quoting again, does not want to discourage stablecoin issuers from investing reserve assets, particularly in deposits of community banks. So if you imagine stablecoin deposits spread very widely around the financial system, particularly in community banks, you get an even tighter nexus between banking risk or the risk of the banking system in general and the stablecoin risk. And in this entanglement of the banking risk and the stablecoin risk, which is, I think Nellie is right, it is a two-way entanglement, is certainly a very important issue for all of these forthcoming regulations to address. And as Governor Barr has suggested there, this all represents, in my opinion, too, a serious financial stability risk for the regulations to contemplate and address. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you, Alex. And then, you know, let me, Alex mentioned 3,000 insured depository institutions failing historically in the United States. Governor Barr, bank deposits have FDIC insurance. They have access to the Fed discount window as well as other Fed programs meant to provide liquidity. Stablecoins have neither, yet both are meant to trade at par. If stable, you know, some people are projecting stablecoin issuance growing to $3 trillion or more. I happen to find that plausible by 2030. There's a lot of payments that could use more efficient payment rails. So it seems like that could be plausible. But if a major, you know, Alex was giving us a little bit of scary scenarios. So let me jump into a scary scenario. A major issuer faces a run. What happens? We're expecting you to tell us that, don't worry, the Fed will step in as lender of last resort using its 13A. I guess that's not the case. So Governor Barr, let us know how you think that would play out.
Well, I think that would be a terrible idea, Gary. I don't think that the Federal Reserve should be backing stablecoins. I don't think that stablecoins should have access to the discount window or deposit insurance. I don't think the Fed should intervene on an emergency basis to prop up stablecoins. Stablecoins were supposed to be this kind of cool new thing where it's only the private sector doing it and standing on its own 2 feet. And I don't think entangling government support in this makes any sense. What we need to make sure for stablecoins to be stable and used is that there's strong regulation up front. There's strong controls on reserve requirements. There are capital requirements. There's supervision. There's controls on money laundering and terrorist financing. We need to make sure those regulations are strong up front so that people can rely on stablecoins being stable. But I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's a terrible idea to have the government subsidize stablecoins or to step in to prop up stablecoins. I would be adamantly opposed to that.
Okay. Well, thank you. That makes sense. And by the way, just for all of our panelists, we're going to go into a bit of a lightning round with the questions, just because we have so many from the audience and they're great questions. And I want to make sure we can accommodate some of them. But Greg, I mean, Multicoin invests across stablecoin issuers, DeFi protocols, and infrastructure players. Looking at the OCC's proposed rule that we were discussing before, and for the audience, that's implementing this Genius Act, which provides a framework, a federal framework for stablecoins to be issued. Which proposed provisions are most likely to reshape the competitive landscape? If I needed to know what I really should pay attention to, that's going to change the landscape of the financial universe, what should I be looking at, Craig? You're on mute.
Was going to happen to someone today. Why not me? First, let's acknowledge that a Genius Act regulated stablecoin is one of four stablecoin types that are in the ecosystem more broadly. You will have non-regulated payment stablecoins that look similar but are not regulated by Genius. One example of that would be the offshore version of Tether, which is presently the largest stablecoin out there. The second would be what might be referred to as a decentralized stablecoin, one which is purely endogenous to a blockchain. And a good example of that would be MakerDAO with the DAI stablecoin that never touches banks, never touches dollars. The fourth version, which has yet to have a successful implementation, is an algorithmic or an under-collateralized stablecoin. Those, generally speaking, not great. We saw a major crisis in 22 around the Terra Luna attempt at an algorithmic stablecoin, which could have certainly had better safeguards and rails to avoid that disaster. But what Genius does, it is addressing the U.S. regulated payment stablecoins. And the first and foremost things that it does is it makes these kosher or halal. You can actually start engaging with these in some sense of trust in that you know there is a regulatory framework. New York Department of Financial Services did a very good job, but now we're bringing it to the federal level with a state path available. The actual provisions in the OCC NPRM that are going to be very interesting to see how the comment and rulemaking process goes. The first will be the rebuttable presumption on yield. Yield is not very well defined. When I opened a SunTrust bank account in 1995, my first personal checking account, I got a toaster. Is that yield? Probably not. I did get burned on it, but
totally worth it.
Totally worth it. What is yield? What is a permitted activity? What is something that looks like deposit interest? Those are going to be core things to figure out, largely because the most expansive potential reading of a rebuttable presumption is that you cannot engage in marketing or distribution arrangements. Regardless of what the end user token experience, we should not be in a position where US regulated stablecoin issuers can't deploy capital for distribution purposes and compete with their unregulated offshore counterparts.
All right, so quick follow. Oh, go ahead, Greg. I didn't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, and then just a second one, which I think will be very important, is this question of whether one brand can have one issuer. And it goes to the question of white labeling. And in particular, there are two companies in the space, Anchorage, which is OCC chartered, and Paxos, which is New York Limited Purpose Trust Charter. Both of them have had some success in creating a white label infrastructure to allow people to launch stable coins within their framework. Whereas what is uncertain in Genius and OCC rulemaking is whether or not that will be permitted, or whether or not one charter means one set of books. And if you want to launch another white label stablecoin, you need an entirely separate charter.
Yeah, it's a little bit surprising because Visa white labels all over the place. I mean, it's a normal thing in the fintech world. It's not like it was suddenly created, this idea of white labeling. So super quick follow-up. You mentioned Tether Offshore. Are there any, there are provisions in the Genius Act which theoretically allow a non-bank issuer or a non-US issuer to issue a stablecoin? Different pathways, but they both have to go through something called the SCRC. And one of the questioners here, and ties into one of the questions we got, how would you address the concern that Genius Act's zero yield environment will lead to large capital flight to the digital yuan or Templeton Biddle options? Like, how do you avoid, how do you have a competitive landscape, or is it currently competitive?
Yeah, I think it currently is competitive. We see this when we're investing in offshore jurisdictions or looking at investing in companies that are going to target offshore jurisdictions. If you ask all $8 billion people on the planet what they most want to hold, it's U.S. dollars. And it's not for the interest that bears off of a U.S. bank account. There isn't much of that. What it is they prefer the US dollar to their local currency. That is one of the reasons why the Genius Act and stablecoins are an important initiative, is it is a projection of geopolitical strength through the dollar, as well as through US treasuries. Now, a slight shift off of that question is, what happens when we are in a very low interest rate environment? And this is something that hasn't been discussed over the course of the last 5 years. But when people were launching stablecoins in 18, 19, 20, one of the big questions was profitability from them. Tether has been famously, and Circle have been famously very profitable based on the reserve holdings, because we're at stable, relatively robust interest rates on treasuries, or yields on treasuries. What happens if those yields collapse a little and the profitability of stablecoins? These are things that have to be factored in, and there are alternative means potentially to generate revenue, including transaction-based fees, although most stablecoin issuers today are simply earning their profits off of reserve holdings. Go ahead, Gary.
Greg, you put more money in the banks because they'll pay you more than the Treasury will.
And just to be clear, everybody, what we're talking about, there's this one-to-one ratio that the Genius Act requires. So every $1 in stablecoin that's issued, there needs to be a dollar of either actual dollars in a deposit account or short-term treasuries. And so that's what we're talking about, the one-to-one. Now, those do pay interest. A deposit account or short-term treasuries pay interest. So if I'm a stablecoin issuer, I can make money by providing the service of the stable coin, but then taking the US dollar and getting a return on it that somebody paid to get the stable coin issued.
Gary, if I could, though, because it goes to what Alex's comment and Governor Barr's comments earlier, both go to this very important component. The Genius Act, its principal function is regulating what can be in the reserve. And one of the things, Alex, that I worry about is in a low interest rate environment, we need the Genius Act to prevent issuers from going up the risk curve in order to increase profitability. So I think that's an essential component, Governor.
I totally agree with Greg. I mean, that's key. There's huge incentives, particularly in a lower rate environment, for people to stretch risk. And so you got to be very tight on the reserve requirements.
Right. Well, on the subject of how tight these reserve requirements should be, Alex, I wanted to ask you about this. You've argued before that allowing stablecoin reserves to be parked at uninsured deposits at parent banks. So what we're talking about is if I'm an OCC national bank, I can't, unless I'm a national trust bank, don't worry about that charter. But if I'm a national bank, I can't directly issue a stablecoin, a payment stablecoin. I have to set up a subsidiary to do it, but I can take the deposits and put it at my parent bank. I can put those reserves with my parent bank. And Alex has argued that that creates a business model almost identical to the one that fueled the SNL crisis, which is the time, it wasn't the Great Depression when the greatest number of banks failed. It was actually during the SNL crisis, if we count savings and loan institutions as banks, for that purpose.
Well, they're certainly insured depositories.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, if we use that definition, which I think is an appropriate definition, it was the greatest number of failures was then. Neither the OCC's nor the FDIC's proposed rules directly prohibit intra-group deposit reserve arrangements. What are your thoughts? Why should we be worried about that, in your opinion?
If you think about, as I tried to briefly suggest in my comments, what is the real asset behind the stablecoin if you do that? Either the bank sets up its own stablecoin sub or the stablecoin issuer sets up his own bank, theoretically a parent company, issues the stablecoins, creates, quote, reserves through depositing them in the affiliated bank. What is the asset then that's behind the stablecoin? Well, it's whatever the bank does. And banks do a lot more. In fact, they hold hardly any treasury bills in their assets. They hold all kinds of loans that have various kinds of risks, but are often very risky. That's why banks often fail and why they're surrounded with encyclopedic reams of regulation and institutional support that, as we have discussed. So if you are able to simply issue your stable coins, put them in your own bank, the actual asset behind the stable coin is anything that bank does. It might be something very conservative, but it might not be. And so I do think that this affiliation feature is something that regulation needs to address. Also, if you had, let's say, concentration limits on how much of your deposits could be in any one bank, you ought to think about affiliated banks. So if you were a bank holding company that owned 10 banks, could you have 10% of your stablecoin deposits in each of your 10 banks, which would actually be in one owned and controlled entity? I don't know if you've thought about that one over at the Fed. I mean,
does that matter much? Governor because Barr, they're all insured depository institutions. And so one of them, if they're affiliated, would be.
If you're insured, an institution doesn't mean that your deposit is insured, needless to say. And we're talking about deposits which are uninsured.
Right.
I think the affiliate rules are going to matter a lot. I mean, you know, people sometimes say, why do these entities need capital at all? One reason is that they can affiliate with other entities, including banks, and you have to make sure that the capital is covering all those risks. The second is that issuers themselves can do activities beyond what is one-to-one issuance. So service activities and other activities of the issuer might present risk. And then even more basically, if you look at the issuer itself, even with one-to-one reserves, as I said in my opening statement, you can have serious run risk, as we saw with money market funds and as we saw with stablecoins themselves. So capital is absolutely essential for all three reasons. You can't just rely on reserve requirements to have a stable stablecoin.
Let me ask some.
I agree.
Let me get a little less of a pessimistic perspective on this. Let me ask Summer. Summer, you have over 130 members of the Blockchain Association, which you are CEO of. When you are going to bed, what is your single greatest source of regulatory uncertainty that keeps you up at night in the Genius Act? I think I know what the answer is, but let's have you answer.
Yes, I dream in yield. Unfortunately, it kind of follows me everywhere I go. Because it's so important to adoption, you know, to have, this is a marketing tool. This is what is going to drive adoption. And if we are too restrictive on third parties paying what are essentially rewards, just like your credit card rewards that you mentioned, Gary, or the toaster from the bank, if you don't have that, you're not going to see the same adoption. And we are, this is a competitive environment. There are offshore issuers that are the largest market right now. And if we don't have this this way to kind of fuel adoption, you're going to look, you might be looking at a system where the dollar isn't the currency reserve, you know, and that's why this is so important that we see widespread adoption of stable coins. And I think on the yield side, it's that ability to reward people for using these payments. This is a payment system. You want to be able to reward users of, you know, stablecoin so that you get adoption, you get the stablecoin being used the way it was intended. So I think there's a lot of gray area here, and that's what, you know, both the rulemaking is looking at, what Congress is looking at. And I think the greatest, you know, my fear is that we are going to go too far in the direction of everything looks like yield, and you're going to actually be preventing business decisions on rewards on other tokens that you happen to hold along with your stable coin. So there's a real kind of fear of going too far and preventing the stablecoin adoption in the US that we need to see.
And I just want to note, this is what created the LIBOR market. This is what created the euro dollar market. Of course, there's restrictions on banks paying interest, the old Reg Q. And it did lead to, you know, a competitive dynamic where people just swept their, who could, right? Not people like me and ordinary people, but, you know, large institutions that had the wherewithal swept their money into the London market where their US dollars would not be subject to the Reg Q cap. And that's where, by the way, everybody, we got the toasters and everything else, because during high inflation times, interest rates were capped. So banks were saying, well, let's do rewards. These were old school rewards, but let's do rewards, whether it's a toaster or something else. But Governor Barr, I wanted to, and please, all the people have asked questions, I'm going to try to address as many as I can. Forgive me, I won't be able to address all of them, but I'm going to ask Governor Barr this one that we received. The Genius Act's reserve asset list is meant to be exhaustive and safe, but El Salvador has designated Bitcoin as legal tender. So does that create a backdoor where a stablecoin issuer could argue Bitcoin-denominated repo qualifies as a permissible reserve asset, which means one of those things a permitted stablecoin issuer could invest the dollar they get, they issue a stablecoin and they can invest their dollar that they got for it in as a permissible reserve asset. So, and if so, how do regulators close that gap? And I'll note, Governor Barr, I think you addressed this in October 2025. You raised exactly this concern in one of your speeches. Do you want to elucidate on that and along with any suggestions on maybe what the Federal Reserve might be able to do? Or is just this, does the statutory text just tie everybody's hands?
Gary, thank you for that. Yes, I raised this exact issue while Genius was being debated, and then again more formally in a speech in October of last year, because it's so critical for reserve assets to be tightly cabined to really safe assets, for stablecoins actually to be stable. And this, what I think of as a loophole, you might have an issue or argue that Bitcoin repo is a permissible reserve asset for precisely the logic and reason that your questioner described. There's the possibility that Bitcoin could be treated as legal tender in other jurisdictions under the definition of money in the act, which was changed at the last minute in the process. Money was broadened in a way to include some things that most people who are going to purchase a stablecoin would not have thought could conceivably be stable. So I think it's really critical that the regulators use their authority to really cabin reserve assets and to block any argument by issuers that Bitcoin repo is a suitable asset for reserves. That creates the kind of circular risk that Alex was talking about in the banking sector, creates it in the crypto sector. That would be a big mistake. And you saw in the OCC's, proposal in this way, they reserved judgment on this. They basically said, we get to decide what a permissible reserve asset is, and we're going to reserve judgment on this question that hasn't yet been kind of posed to us. I think it's really important not to let that kind of loophole survive the regulatory process.
Okay, well, thank you. I want to ask Greg something that, to build into, I'm going to build on this, but we got asked, how should the AML regulatory framework for stablecoins differ from that for traditional financial institutions or other virtual assets like cryptocurrencies, if at all? And, I want to tie into that the question, the OCC's proposed rule did not address whether DeFi protocol operators or front-end interface operators, and folks on the audience don't know what those are, that's okay. I'll explain in a moment, qualify as so-called digital asset service providers, leaving open a question of, who is going to be responsible? What are the BSA AML requirements for folks who are in the DeFi world? And just to explain to the audience, so if I'm minting a stablecoin token, which means creating one and issuing it, I have to do KYC and AML. So I know who my customer is. I know we're not money laundering. But once it's out there, there becomes a question of when do responsibilities exist and when they don't. So, Greg, do you want to take that on?
Sure. And actually, it's apt timing this morning. I was at a TFI Treasury roundtable addressing illicit finance and digital assets. They've been having a handful of these in DC and New York over the last year or so. And it does raise new issues generally for digital assets, but it also raises new tools. This technology has radical transparency and immediacy of information. Near real-time monitoring becomes available, and that opens up new tools for stablecoin issuers in particular, and folks at Treasury and other government institutions that want to be able to monitor things and ingest data in real time. The important distinction between stablecoins and a traditional digital asset is stablecoins are administered digital assets. And we see this on a regular basis. Circle, Tether, all of the big stablecoin issuers will respond to lawful requests to freeze assets and do have the ability to seize assets in transit, or at least while they're at rest. And that's an important distinction. When we look at secondary markets in stablecoins, and that's another distinguishing feature between stablecoins and traditional runs, is you don't only run to the issuer for redemption, you also have the possibility of exiting on secondary markets or utilizing those stablecoins for personal use or payments purposes. That doesn't change, Alex, your comments about pegs, depegging from time to time, but arbitrage works reasonably well. The Circle, Silvergate was an outlier for a variety of reasons we don't have time to go into. But when we look at who the OCC has sought to regulate in their NPRM is these third-party digital asset service providers. And when we look at DeFi protocols, a crypto trading platform, a Coinbase or a Kraken, what have you, those are clearly DASPs, custodians, clearly DASPs. When we get into DeFi, it's a little bit different. You have the protocol itself, which is, if it's truly decentralized, is not operated by any party. And then you have front ends who will in some form have certain responsibilities, but the AML component of that is still to be written and will follow from market structure. For stablecoin issuers, their AML requirements are going to be particularly with the people they transact with on minting and redeeming, and then responding to government requests for freezes.
Gary, I'll just add quickly, the tighter those controls become on stable coins, which it would be good, I think, the more competitive hope there is for $100 bills to maintain their historical role.
Right. Well, I just want to say that a great conversation always leaves you yearning for more. And that is quite evidently the case here. So many policy questions, they really are almost endless. This has been an extremely interesting discussion. I truly wish we had another hour, but I'm afraid we don't. All of those people who asked these excellent, excellent questions, I'm sorry we couldn't address them all. But thank you, everyone, for attending. And thank you most of all to this great panel. Thank you very much, everybody, for taking your time for doing this. And let me hand it over now to Sarah Clark to round us out.
Thanks, Gary.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Governor Barr, Ms. Mersinger, Mr. Pollack, and Mr. Zalas for speaking with us today, and to Mr. Kalbaugh for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.